the headlines this hour. Iran's Constitutional Council announces a final list of candidates for the upcoming presidential election. 7 people have been approved to run for president. Israeli forces kill a young Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank amid mounting tensions over the regime's eviction order in a Palestinian neighborhood. And the Ansarullah movement voices support for a UN-backed ceasefire in Yemen, but says any such agreement should end the Saudi blockade of the war-torn country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Nias. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Constitutional Council has announced the final list of candidates qualified for the next month's presidential election. 7 people have been approved by the council to run for the top executive post. They are Ebrahim Raisi, Mohsen Rezai, Abdel Nasser Hemati, Saeed Jalili, Ali Reza Zakani, Mohsen Mehralizadeh, and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi. They were qualified to run for president from among nearly 600 hopefuls vetted by the Constitutional Council. The body began vetting those registered for the vote on May 16th. Iranians will go to the polls on June 18th to choose a successor to President Hassan Rouhani. Nearly 60 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Well, Iranians will go to the polls on June the 18th to choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. This is the country's 13th presidential election since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Let's take a look back at the brief history of the previous elections, the voter turnouts, and the candidates who ran for the country's top executive post.
Iran held its first presidential election in less than a year after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution on the 25th of January 1980. Abul Hassan Banisadr was elected as the country's first ever president after securing over 75% of the votes. Iran's first presidential election was held with the participation of more than 14 million people. The presidency of Banisadr ended after he was impeached by Parliament in June 1981. With a landslide victory, former Prime Minister Mohammad Ali Rajai replaced Banisadr. However, Rajai's presidency did not last long. He was assassinated, along with Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar, in a bomb blast on the 30th of August 1981. Rajai's assassination resulted in another early election. This time, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, then a member of parliament, became the third president of the country with more than 95% of the votes. Ayatollah Khamenei was re-elected in 1985 with another overwhelming victory. His presidency coincided with the war Iraq imposed on Iran. During his last weeks in office, the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, passed away. Ayatollah Khamenei was then chosen as the country's leader by the Assembly of Experts on the 4th of June 1989. In Iran's fifth presidential election, influential politician and parliament speaker Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani was elected with more than 15 million votes. In 1993, Rafsanjani was re-elected with a wide margin. However, the general turnout that year was relatively low. Rafsanjani's 8-year presidency is known as the construction period, mainly due to his administration's economic reforms. The voter turnout reached a record high in Iran's 7th presidential election, when nearly 80% of the voting eligible population cast their ballots. Reformist candidate Mohammad Khatami became Iran's president with nearly 70% of the votes. Khatami was re-elected in 2001 for a second term, following another high voter turnout. Iran's 9th presidential election was the first in history to go into a runoff after none of the 7 candidates secured the 50% needed majority in the country's closest ever presidential race. Former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Tehran Mayor Mahmoud Ahmadinejad went into the second round. The runoff led to Ahmadinejad's victory. In 2009, incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was re-elected with 24 million votes. This year recorded the highest percentage of voter turnout in the country's history of presidential elections. However, the final result of the election drew objections over what some claim claimed was election fraud. The allegations were, however, rejected by the country's supervisory bodies, and Ahmadinejad stayed in office as president. Hassan Rouhani became Iran's next president. He served for two terms after victories in the 2013 and the 2017 presidential races. With 50% and 57% majority votes, the reformist-backed president won the country's top executive post in two consecutive elections that witnessed passionate public participation. Who will be the winner of Iran's 13th presidential election? That is a decision Iranians will make on the 18th of June.
The final phase of electronic warfare maneuvers by the Iranian army has successfully come to an end. The drills conducted in central Isfahan province featured electronic disruption and deception, as well as reconnaissance operations. Drills to counter electronic and cyber attacks were carried out also. The exercise also involved operations to protect radar and telecommunication systems using drones, choppers, and airplanes. The Iranian maneuvers featured drills to identify and monitor signal data from land and satellite stations, among other things. Domestically developed radar systems were used to spot hostile drones and micro-air vehicles. Among the key operations was to monitor an American squadron leaving the Strait of Hormuz. Israeli forces have attacked a neighborhood near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, killing a young Palestinian man. The regime has intensified its crackdown on the occupied territories over the past few weeks. Mona Kandil earlier joined us from Ramallah to give us the details.
What happened this morning is that Israeli forces have raided Umm Sharayit neighborhood south Al-Biri city near Ramallah in order to conduct arrest campaigns, according to a statement by the Israeli military. However, an undercover Israeli unit opened fire at Ahmad al-Nimr from Al-Am'ari refugee camp, who was in the area. It seems that clashes took place during the arrest campaigns, and they shot him. However, according to eyewitnesses there, the Israeli undercover unit opened fire towards Ahmad al-Nimr, this young Palestinian man, and left him bleeding without allowing anyone to rescue him. Then he succumbed to his injuries. The Israeli military claims that they were trying to arrest some of his family members, maybe his uncle and brother, during the morning, the pre-dawn operations. We are speaking about 19 Palestinians have been detained in Al-Jalazon refugee camp, in Al-Khalil, in Qalqilia, as well as in Jenin. As you have mentioned, in the last few days, dozens of Palestinians were arrested across the occupied West Bank, and hundreds were detained in the last 2 weeks in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the lands that were occupied in 1948.
Drone footage from Gaza shows the scale of devastation from 11 days of airstrikes and artillery fire by Israel this month. Palestinian officials say the Israeli aggression completely destroyed 2,000 homes and damaged another 15,000 buildings in Gaza. According to local health authorities, the war also killed 253 Palestinians, half of them children, women, and the elderly. That is besides nearly 2,000 people who were injured, including 20 in critical condition. Palestinian officials say the Israeli aggression cost besieged territory tens of millions of dollars in damage. The war ended after Israel announced a unilateral truce before dawn on Friday to end retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. Palestinians later accepted the truce that is holding for now. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has voiced its support for ceasefire amid mediation efforts by the UN. The head of the Ansarullah Supreme Revolutionary Committee says the movement wants a comprehensive ceasefire in all of its forms. Mohammed Ali Al-Houthi says any such agreement should end the Saudi blockade on Yemen. UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths is now in Saudi Arabia for consultations as part of efforts toward a nationwide ceasefire. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched their war on Yemen in 2015 to topple Ansarullah and to reinstate a former president. Last month, Riyadh proposed a peace plan under which Yemen would receive fuel and other commodities through its Hodeidah port. Ansarullah rejected the initiative, saying that it does not accept a deal that partially lifts the siege of the key port. Syrians are going to the polls on Wednesday to elect the next president for the next 7 years. This year's presidential election comes as the Syrian government has been able to liberate most of the territory occupied by the foreign-backed terrorists over the past years. Damascus, Mohammed Ali reports.
For 10 days, Syrian presidential candidates have been campaigning for the upcoming presidential elections scheduled on Wednesday. three candidates are competing for leading the country, current President Bashar al-Assad, a Syria-based opposition figure Mahmoud Mir'i, and a former MP and minister Abdullah Abdullah. It's the first time an opposition figure runs for presidency in Syria. He mainly calls for the release of political prisoners, change of laws, and a national dialogue conference between authorities and the opposition.
My program includes issues publicly raised for the first time in the history of Syria, such as the release of political prisoners. I call for a national unity government, including opposition figures. There are, of course, certain opposition groups outside Syria working hand in hand with countries occupying our lands. Some of them even held talks with Israel and Turkey. I will never deal with them. They are traitors.
Bashar al-Assad titled his campaign Hope in Work, focusing on unity, reconstruction, increasing domestic production for boosting the economy and fighting corruption. The third candidate calls for unity as well as fighting terrorism and corruption. Meanwhile, Syrians have been taking to the streets in support of the election process after several countries opposed it.
The Syrian people have a constitutional duty to vote. Today, colonialist countries are trying to block us from voting, but we tell them no one can undermine our will. We will vote.
Holding presidential elections on time sends a clear message to the world that Syria is a country that respects its constitution. It also sends a message to the enemies of Syria that we defeated terrorism. Now we are going to reconstruct our country.
Authorities have set over 12,000 electoral centers across the country. Heads of electoral centers took their constitutional oath, marking the state's readiness to hold the elections on the 26th of May. The significance of this year's elections is that it happens with government control of most of Syrian territories. Regardless of the opposition of some countries to Syria's presidential elections, and regardless of who becomes president of the Syrian Arab Republic for the next 7 years, Syrians will be the winners, as they are the ones who will vote and decide on the leadership of their nation. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The European Union moves to impose strict sanctions on Belarus and apply additional sanctions on Russia, while ignoring crimes against humanity committed by Israel during the regime's recent bombardment of Palestinian territories. Jerome Hughes has more.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders agreed to ban Belarus from using the 27-nation bloc's airspace, and EU aircraft will no longer fly over Belarus. Leaders say Alexander Lukashenko's government forced a flight from Greece to Lithuania to land in Minsk on Sunday to facilitate the arrest of Belarusian opposition activist Roman Protasevich, who was on board.
There will be additional sanctions on individuals that are involved in the hijacking, but this time also on businesses and economic entities that are financing this regime.
Even before the Belarus situation developed, this summit was due to be dominated by the subject of Russia. And listen to this part of the agenda. We will briefly discuss the situation in the Middle East. Rights groups say this clearly illustrates the value EU leaders place on the lives of Palestinians. In fact, at the summit's main press conference, the atrocities committed this month by Israel were not mentioned once. So, new sanctions for Belarus, but no chance of measures against Tel Aviv.
We've seen in the past that whenever a country takes stances, not even sanctions, but stances against Israel, Israel is always going to retaliate harder, is always going to play hardball, is always going to overbid. And right now, no EU country is actually willing to enter in such a confrontational spiral.
EU leaders have instructed the European Commission to compile a new report on Russia. They claim Moscow is responsible for all sorts of problems. The new report will pave the way for additional sanctions.
You know that we have already taken sanctions against Russia, and on a regular basis we have the opportunity at the level of the European Council to tackle the situation of the sanctions.
The Kremlin always asks the EU to back up its claims of wrongdoing with proof. Analysts say this is rarely forthcoming. Rights groups and a number of EU legislators say this summit once again highlights the West's blatant hypocrisy, turning a blind eye when it's difficult and acting tough when it's easy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
India has recorded over 196,000 new coronavirus cases, which is its lowest 24-hour caseload in over a month. The nation also recorded more than 3,500 new deaths on Tuesday, one day after its total death toll passed a grim milestone of 300,000. The figure has pushed India's total caseload up to around 27 million and its deaths to more than 307,000. India's COVID death toll is the third largest in the world, after the U.S. and Brazil. The Asian country has battled the second wave of COVID-19 for weeks. That caused a health crisis with hospitals overwhelmed and facing oxygen supplies as well as medicines. The surge also forced partial or complete lockdowns in most states. Correspondent New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says the decline in India's coronavirus cases seems to be the result of the government's restrictive measures.
If we look at the government figures, this is a phenomenal change. If we remember, last week or 2 weeks ago, we used to register around 400,000 cases every day, and the death toll was also mounting. So the good news is, if we believe on the government data, which many have always argued that the numbers are 5 to 7 to 10 times higher what the government says, because you're talking about India as a subcontinent. It's not a small place. It's a huge country with a massive population of more than 1.3 billion people. But let's go with the government figures. Well, that's good news. Yes, of course, the cases have come down from 400,000 to now below 200,000. And of course, the death toll has also slightly shown some trends of declining. If we take into consideration the last week's death toll, it was over 4,000 and more, it was keeping it every day. But now the government figures show it's somewhere around 3,500, which is also a good change. But we talk about rural parts of the country, mate. We see now the trends are changing. There are so many changes in the metropolis. The cases are declining. It's just because of the fact that we see a big lockdowns, strict measures, people following the guidelines after the second wave hit the country hardest. Now the tide is changing a little bit. Now the rural parts of the country are getting more affected.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Message to the Palestinian nation for their victory over the Zionist regime, May 21st, 2021.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, my greetings to the powerful, oppressed Palestine. Greetings to the brave, zealous Palestinian youth. Greetings to the heroic, resistant Gaza. Greetings to Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all jihadi and political groups in Palestine. I thank God the Almighty for granting his assistance and for the honor he has bestowed on the Palestinian fighters. I ask God the Beneficent to bestow tranquility and peace of mind on the injured hearts of the bereaved, to shower his mercy and glad tidings on the martyrs, and to completely heal the wounded. I also extend my congratulations on this victory against the criminal Zionist regime. The recent test over these few days has honored the Palestinian nation. The savage, wolf-like enemy has realized correctly that it is powerless when facing the unified uprising of Palestine. This test, the cooperation between Quds and the Western Bank with Gaza and 48 territories and Palestinian camps, has shown the future solution to the Palestinians. Over the past 12 days, the violent regime committed immense crimes, especially in Gaza. They have proven in practice that it can behave so shamelessly and idiotically as a result of its incapability in confronting the unified uprising of the Palestinians that it provokes the public opinion of the world against itself. They have added to the hatred against themselves and the Western governments that support it, in particular the criminal US. The continuation of their crimes and their request for a true meaning and the request for a truce mean the defeat of the Zionists. The Zionists were forced to accept defeat.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine,
the malicious regime will become even weaker. The preparedness of the Palestinian youth, the show of power by valuable jihadi groups, and a continual increase in the elements of power will make Palestinians stronger day by day, and it will render the uprising enemy weaker and more despicable with each passing day. The time to begin and to end the clashes depend on the discernment of the great jihadi and political leaders of Palestine. But being prepared and maintaining a powerful presence in the field cannot be stopped. The experience in Sheikh Jarrah in resisting the aggression of the regime and the mercenary inhabitants of the settlements should become a perpetual plan of action for the courageous people of Palestine. I salute the valiant youth of Sheikh Jarrah. The entire world of Islam has responsibilities and religious obligations with respect to the Palestinian cause. Political common sense and experience in ruling and governing confirm and put emphasis on this religious edict. Muslim governments should earnestly enter the field to support the Palestinian nation in both military and financial areas, which is needed more than the past, and to help in rebuilding infrastructures and the ruins in Gaza. The nations demanding and pursuing this matter is a source of support for this religious and political call. Muslim nations should demand that their governments carry out their duties. Nations themselves have the responsibility to provide financial and political support as much as they are able to. Another important responsibility is pursuing the matter of the publishment of the terrorist, bloodthirsty Zionist regime. All conscientious people in the world agree that the widespread crime of massacring Palestinian children and women over the past 12 days should not remain unpunished. All of the regime's agents who were involved in this crime and the criminal Netanyahu himself should be prosecuted and punished by independent international courts of law. And this will surely happen with God's power. And Allah has command of his affairs. Holy Quran, chapter 12, verse 21.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
the recent Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip began on May 10th after the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started eviction plans of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire. However, this time Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Finally, after 11 days of brutal Israeli attacks that killed at least 279 Palestinians, including 69 children, the occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on Friday, which was accepted by Palestinian resistance groups with Egyptian mediation. People in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank hailed the truce as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups in the face of Israel's attacks. The 11-day-long Israeli aggression resulted in the displacement of over 90,000 Gazans and the destruction of Gaza's critical infrastructure and many civilian buildings. International NGOs and Gaza officials say several hospitals and schools, as well as power and sewage plants, have been severely damaged. The Red Cross says that Gaza could take years to rebuild. Moreover, Palestinian lawyers say the Israeli army's use of live fire and rubber-coated bullets from short range against Palestinian demonstrators is a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has sent a letter to the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's office, including documents on new and ongoing crimes, calling for an investigation into Israel's war crimes in Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem Al-Quds.
I think that now, following the horrific damage that Israel did, wherein it targeted homes, medical centers, press buildings, these are all in blatant violation of international law. And much as Israel liked to say that Hamas had some presence there, there is no evidence to support that. So I think this time, with an investigation about to begin regarding possible war crimes that Israel committed in 2014, I do believe that these will be added to it.
Fall.
following a ceasefire between Tel Aviv and Palestinian resistance groups, after 11 days of Israel's deadly war on the Gaza Strip, Hamas and the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, Al-Quds Brigades, thanked Iran for its unwavering support for the Palestinian resistance, saying Iran is a partner in the victory against Israel. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, congratulated Palestinians for their victory against Israel. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Palestinians' resistance left the Zionist regime with no choice but to request a ceasefire.
The regime's defeat was manifested both in its continued crimes and its request for a ceasefire. The Israeli regime was forced to concede defeat.
The Iranian leader noted that the Israeli regime will get weaker than what it is today, while the preparedness of resistance forces will make Palestine stronger day by day. He also called on the entire Muslim nations to feel responsible for the Palestinian cause.
Muslim governments should enter the scene with sincerity to support the Palestinian nation, whether by boosting their military might or lending financial support. This is required more than ever before for the reconstruction of the infrastructure and repairing the damage done to Gaza.
Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that the crimes Israel committed during its latest onslaught should not be left unpunished. He said Israeli authorities, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, must be brought to justice in independent international tribunals.
The defeat will indirectly do that, because Israel has seen, the Israeli government has seen, that it no longer has the level of support around the world that it once believed it had. People spoke up in the streets. There were mass demonstrations in support of Palestine around the world. Many governments, although they were critical of Hamas, unjustly critical, they were also critical of Israel. This is new. Israel no longer can do whatever it wants with complete impunity.
Israel launched an offensive on the Gaza Strip and approved a ceasefire without any preconditions or strategic breakthrough. This means the Palestinian resistance has taught Israelis an important lesson, and that is the Israeli enemy is incapable of facing Palestine's united uprising.
Palestinians have poured to the streets to celebrate their victory over Israel in the 11-day fighting between the two sides. Rallies were held across the besieged Gaza Strip in condemnation of the Israeli regime and celebration of its defeat. Gatherings were also held in the occupied West Bank, where joyful participants cheered for the victory for the resistance. The celebrations came after an Egypt-brokered ceasefire went into effect on Friday morning, ending the fiercest battle there in years. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire, but this time, Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Experts believe that Israel has succumbed to the unprecedented response by the Palestinian resistance and agreed to the ceasefire without any preconditions.
I think it's a huge win. The fact is that never before have we seen Israel penetrated militarily, psychologically, and morally in this way before. The sheer numbers of Palestinian resistance missiles that actually penetrated the Iron Dome is absolutely incredible. This much vaunted dome, which was meant to protect the Israeli civilians, essentially collapsed, because my estimation is around 30% of the missiles got through. And what were these missiles? Essentially, they were just homemade rockets. Not only that, what we've seen is that this, for the first time, turned into an insurrection within occupied Palestinian territory. Within the colony itself, they call Israel, you saw huge numbers of Palestinians demonstrating and rising up, and actually huge clashes took place. A lot of that would have been suppressed.
People across the world have shown their solidarity with Palestinians in the past few days. In the United States, protesters called for the cessation of all funding to Israel. Israeli regime was targeting the people of Palestine, the U.S. administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli regime. The arms deal is now pending the approval of Congress. Several American congresspeople, including Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib, objected to the plan and introduced motions to block the sales. But given the traditionally strong support for Israel in the Congress, the motions will almost certainly fail.
The U.S. is totally $3.5 billion per annum is donated by Israel to by America to Israel in order to sustain its arms industry. As the bombs were falling Palestinian children, you found that Joe Biden cleared $750 million of aid for arms and missiles to Israel. So that was the initial response of America.
In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, expressing hope that it would hold. He, however, reaffirmed the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
The United States and its arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other compared to the chaotic era of former U.S. President Donald Trump. But tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, one being the resource-rich South China Sea. Chinese and American military vessels have had numerous encounters there. This week, China said an American warship illegally entered its territorial waters in the sea, but was expelled by Chinese ships and planes. Beijing was quick to slam the U.S. action, branding it as a violation of China's sovereignty. Beijing warned that such moves undermine regional peace and stability. However, the U.S. Navy said its vessel asserted navigational rights and freedoms near a number of islands claimed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam. China believes that America has fully abandoned its supposed neutrality in the region and is clearly siding with nations which have rival territorial claims in the South China Sea.
The United States is trying to transform these maritime disputes in the South China Sea. These are typical maritime disputes that you'll find all over the world, including in places like Europe, between European nations. The U.S. is trying to transform this from mere disputes into a regional, even global conflict, because they need to have a pretext to justify their military remaining in the region.
Naval tensions between the U.S. and China are not limited to the South China Sea. Earlier this week, an American destroyer sailed through the Taiwan Strait, angering Beijing, which considers self-ruled Taiwan a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. China wants the U.S. to respect its territorial integrity and has repeatedly warned that this red line must never be crossed. Technological rivalry between the United States and China is expanding fast, especially in highly advanced sectors like 5G, artificial intelligence, and the semiconductor industry. The U.S. Senate voted this week to advance a bill authorizing well over $100 billion for technology research in the face of Chinese rivalry. The Endless Frontier Act is a huge investment in emerging sciences and manufacturing on a scale not seen in decades. The legislation has bipartisan support. Politicians from both major camps in the United States have a rising sense of urgency to bolster America's ability to compete with China. The urgency was also highlighted in U.S. President Joe Biden's first speech to Congress last month. During his address, the U.S. president left no doubt that America will do its utmost to outpace the Asian superpower in terms of trade and technology. Biden identifies China as the toughest foreign policy challenge. His administration is trying hard to reduce American reliance on Chinese technology in areas that Washington believes raise national security risks and protect critical technologies from being transferred to China. The U.S. president has also said the American military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch rival. The Biden administration has toned down anti-Beijing rhetoric, but what's certain is that America is determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide.
The United States has been the sole superpower for decades, and then with the resurgence of Russia and now China's rise, they're watching their global primacy slip away. So even though there's many excuses for why they have this conflict with China, the main reason is they cannot accept that China, even though it has a larger population and plenty of resources, they cannot accept the fact that China is going to surpass them.
As the U.S. intensifies efforts against its main global rival, China is expected to pursue its own ways to catch up with and even overtake America in different fields.
Boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has urged people around the world to boycott Israeli and multinational firms complicit in Tel Aviv's regime's abuse of Palestinian human rights. A fresh call comes amid Israel's relentless bombardment of the Gaza Strip. There's a growing consensus that Israel now, like South Africa in the past, is an apartheid state that must be met with targeted sanctions, boycotts, and divestments.
Well, I would not say that the governments of any countries have the will to try and boycott Israel or take any really clear measures against Israel. But I would say that among students and among, for example, the Arab American movement in the U.S., I think there is more of a will to say, no, we have to cut off the arms to Israel. We have to cut off the aid and the trade to Israel, exactly as we did with apartheid South Africa. There's more of a will to say that.
The movement says the measures can help challenge the complicity of international firms in Israeli crimes against Palestinians and help the struggle of Palestinians for freedom, justice, and equality. BDS activists are now trying to translate the activism that has been generated among celebrities and cultural icons into meaningful change. Football figures in the UK and the Arab world, Black Lives Matter activists in the UK, as well as several progressive U.S. lawmakers, have voiced their opposition to Israeli crimes against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The movement says there's growing consensus that, like South Africa in the past, Israel is an apartheid regime that must be met with action.
These students have built up a level of confidence now that makes them react more loudly when Israel starts mass bombardments of the Palestinian people. So you have more confident crowds of protesters, and that is driving these few liberal politicians to push President Biden in the direction of cutting off the military aid to Israel. And Biden is an old Zionist who doesn't want to do that ever, but they are pushing him more in that direction.
The fresh round of violence started after Israeli troops and settlers announced plans to expel dozens of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Illegal Israeli settlers are looking to take over the properties of Palestinian families. This is not an isolated incident. Since its creation in 1948, Israel has used discriminatory and racist policies against Palestinians in various forms. There is now a general consensus that the racist policies of the Israeli regime are similar to the ones implemented by the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Black Lives Matter is more loud and clear and confident about opposing Israel because Israel so much resembles apartheid South Africa. And the willingness of some politicians, as you mentioned, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar, the willingness of some politicians to oppose Israel, to oppose aid to Israel, is something new. They are gradually inching their way towards saying cut off the military aid to Israel. They're not there.
The BDS movement seeks to raise global awareness about these policies and discourage companies from doing business with the occupiers of Palestinian lands. The BDS movement, which is modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, was initiated in 2005 by over 170 Palestinian organizations that were pushing for various forms of boycott against Israel until it met its obligations under international law. Thousands of volunteers worldwide have since then joined the BDS movement. Israel has spared no effort to undermine the movement. Back in 2011, the Knesset passed a measure to curb its activities.
I cannot think of anything more foolish than to say that you want to have any kind of divestment or sanctions or whatever, or boycott against a country that, when all is said and done, is the only democracy in the region.
We must continue to stand firm against the profoundly biased campaign to delegitimize the state of Israel through boycotts, divestment, and sanctions.
The BDS movement is often linked to those kinds of frames. So I will continue to condemn the BDS movement.
The Tel Aviv regime has started a huge lobby campaign with pro-Israeli groups around the world to undermine the BDS. Back in 2019, U.S. House lawmakers passed a bipartisan resolution condemning the movement.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Welcome to another episode of Olama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
روایت در ثواب الاعمال مرحوم صدوق کامل آمده آخرین خطبه پیامبر در مبارد.
There is a hadith in the book ثواب الاعمال by Sheikh As-Saduq narrated from the Holy Prophet of Islam. This hadith is included among the last sermons of Prophet Muhammad regarding ethics. This sermon and the hadith taken from it have a cautionary nature rather than a rewarding one. In other words, it warns the people about the consequences of sins and satanic deeds. I hope that my explanation regarding this hadith reaches all the youths, especially those who are very much busy with social networks and social media, because this hadith will help them a lot to stop the negative effects of the atmosphere in which they are living. It also gives warning to those who violate the privacy of others in social media or interfere in the private affairs of others.
مطلب یک خط من مشا.
This hadith is only one line. The Prophet states, the person who gossips behind others or slanders about others will have a harsh and tough situation when buried after death. Now, some other narrations resembles the hardness of the first night of the grave into the flaming fire. This means that those who are always busy with the affairs of others must wait for a difficult time during the first hours of grave. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Olama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter, the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want the
of
United
law.
States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then President of the United States, told Eben that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eben. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. Forty-five minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldberg asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the UN. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the U.S. On October 6, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to